All right, so we're on. Like to welcome you again to Roots of the Right and episode 6. This is the culture of narcissism, and it's America in an age of diminishing expectations. Is that the tagline? I think.
Exactly. Yep. American life in the age of diminishing expectations.
Perfect. And that was the voice of none other than our very, very special guest, Mr. Borzo Boskovic. Yes. Do you want to just introduce yourself a bit?
Yes, for those who are not familiar with me, I'm a TRS podcaster on therightstuff.biz. God only knows, like, if for anybody who's coming into this at whenever, like, I'm currently at Edward B. Chang on Twitter. Let's see how, don't think that's going to last, but we'll see how long that lasts. I have a lot of, the only reason why I plug is because I do a lot of my takes on there. But yeah, you can find my shows on therightstuff.biz where I talk about, where I have the pause button, which should be coming back on hiatus soon. I'm a co-host on the Third Rail, and I'm a co-host of the People Square, which is also currently on hiatus, but that's Eric Stryker's thing. I tend to like a pop up. Like I've guest hosted on pretty much everything at this point. Like I pop up everywhere. Like I've been on Interregnum, all that. Check it all out.
Mm. Yeah, I think we've all been fans of your content at this show for a long time. I'm sure Demok, who joins us again this time, could back me up. Is that right?
Yep. Don't mind checking out your Twitter threads time to time. Actually,
I was just going to say, like, that's where that's how this episode started out. It was a lash thread, basically.
Yeah, I think I did catch that one. Not a big podcast listener, surprisingly, but do follow your Twitter threads time to time.
Mm. We've also read, I read your work recently on National Justice. Have you written for them, or were you just...
The funny thing is I don't know, like, I got to finish my other essay right now, the vaporware essay that's been about humiliation that I've talked about for 2 months now. But right. Once I finish that, Stryker has asked me to write for national-justice.com. He wants me to do specifically an article on Lash's The Culture of Narcissism. So since I just finally finished the book, that'll be forthcoming at some point. But you can find my work as well on I should have plugged that. You can find some of my blog posts at raceboars.com. But my main work, my big pieces, are over at The American Sun. Just look for John Chapman. That's the pseudonym I use over there. Not my real name, don't worry. That's actually the name of Johnny Appleseed. That's where the name comes from.
Ah. So there's plenty of your work to check out. You've been in this thing and creating some really high quality stuff for a long time. I listen to the Pause Button a fair bit. The Third Rail, I know, is a favorite show for many of our listeners and pretty much all the hosts. So it's a real honor to have you on board. So you were the one who suggested this book. Now, why did you do that?
So one issue I always have, I guess, with the right wing is that you get into this thing, and especially because, like, there's always, like, you're introduced to a bunch of ideas you've never been introduced to before because of the way that the system works. Mm. And unfortunately, what tends to happen is people tend to go towards the same books. It almost gets, like, a very meme-like after a while. And I don't like using that term because there's a lot of those works are well worth reading. Like, there's nothing that should dissuade you from reading those works. But people tend to get too comfortable in that. So I've always kind of tried to find stuff that was outside of that, that had pertinent insights, that had important insights more than anything to anything we're doing. And it was actually, I don't even know why Eric Stryker was talking about it, but we were talking on a People's Square once, and he happened to mention Christopher Lash's book, The Revolt of the Elites, which was Lash's critique, basically, of the kind of like the meritocratic class, the elite class in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I had heard the name Lash, like, bandied about a couple times before, but when Stryker mentioned that, that's when I decided, like, I need to check this out. And I happened to find a copy of that, but I also happened to find Culture of Narcissism. Since I'm more of a culture guy than I am a political guy, it's like, okay. And also, this was making me think of The Last Psychiatrist, who was actually, he doesn't write anymore, but I highly recommend checking out The Last Psychiatrist. his blog posts about narcissism are some of the some of the best content the internet ever produced. Like, he had some amazing insights into culture. Narcissism was the big, like, he had clearly been a reader of Lash. Like, narcissism was his big thing. So with all that in mind, it's like, okay, I need to check this out. And within the first 10 pages, like, I was sold on this book. And I think everyone else will be too. If you check, like, just read the first 10 pages of this book, and if you're not sold on it immediately, then you're not going to like the rest of the book, basically. It's it gives you such a penetrating look into the absolute state of like the psychological state and socialized state of our societies. And that's why people should read it. That's why people should read it.
Definitely. Yeah, I got a lot of the same stuff. I haven't checked out The Last Psychiatrist, though, so we'll definitely link that in the show notes. I just got some basic sort of practical background for the book. So I think it's his best known work, published in 1979. Lash himself lived from 1932 to 1994. So in this work, he outlined an emergent personality and style that have since taken control of elite and mass political culture. So he was appalled by the exploding therapeutic sensibility, so kind of self-help culture or new wave stuff that promised freedom, creativity, and mental health. He argued prophetically in 1979, so this is in this work, that self-expression and radical individualism could yield disastrous social results. That was just from his wiki page and some information that I pulled from that. There was another article that I saw too, which talked about, almost 40 years in hindsight, Lash's takes relating to the current sort of state surrounding Trump, etc. And it said, quote, Lash was surveying a way of life that is dying. The culture of competitive individualism, which in its decadence has carried the logic of individualism to the extreme of a war of all against all. The pursuit of happiness to the dead end of a narcissistic preoccupation with the self, end quote. That was from a website called The Federalist, which I don't read too much, but
the Federalist is a well-known conservative website. They kind of try to I would call them mainstream conservatism, but they definitely track towards a very kosher type.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So, it kind of just practical framing information there, really. But yeah, I didn't read too much further down in the piece. Just getting to get background for people who haven't read the book.
Yeah, I could actually give some further context as well. Sure. One of the reasons, Lash, this book specifically tends to be resurrected by non-individualist conservatives, especially because Lash himself was a critic of progressivism and libertarianism, and so he's the only kind of people he's ever really had favor with, in his post-mortem career, has been the cultural conservative types who unfortunately they kind of myopically see Lash as a critic of the hippie style individualism, and that was a problem with The Culture of Narcissism when it was first published, because it was a sensation when it was published. It actually won a book award. It wasn't just this obscure tome that got vindicated years later. This was actually a popular book when it came out, and unfortunately I think Lash's book was a victim of its own success, because it kind of, you can actually kind of see echoes of this in the afterword, where he kind of very subtly kind of implies that people somewhat misunderstood his book and what the intentions were, because people took it as simply a critique of hippies and in the me generation and the me decade, which was the 70s and all that. And it was actually, Lash was seeing this as the end result of how things got to that point. And I think a lot of people missed that critique of that. And I think if you want to understand, because where this all kind of derives from, the documentary series you want to check out is Adam Curtis's The Century of the Self, because it leads into the kind of people, the hippie movement, Jerry Rubin, who's also mentioned in Culture of Narcissism. It talks about all that, how basically after the failure of the 1968 movements, these people fell into this like, kind of self-help, hedonist, decadence, it's all about me kind of culture that carried through for the next 10 years. And that was actually engineered on a systemic level. This is the stuff that Lash was nipping around the edges on. And that's why people tended to, I think people just kind of missed what he was doing with that, which is why the book kind of just, especially like, especially when we went into the Reagan years, the Reagan and Thatcher years, where you had like the conservative movements constantly hijacked by these individualist libertarian type stuff that has never gone away since then. The Lash, especially because Lash was a neo-Marxist to begin with, a Freudian neo-Marxist.
Yeah,
people were quite happy to kind of discard him, even though like he actually had a lot of very insightful things to say.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to note his family background, like a very liberal sort of intellectual family, and he kind of aims in both at both sides of the political spectrum, if you can kind of simplify it to that. I think that's really one of his strengths, is he doesn't reserve particularly strong criticisms for either quote-unquote side. He's pretty even-handed, and his critique, as you, I think, rightly point out, is charting the rise of what he terms a culture of narcissism and the effects that it's had, and also sort of looking at what has underpinned that. And seemingly without sort of political affiliation too much, yeah. But I think, yeah, you're right. His book was a bestseller at the time. Like, I think it hit number one. I don't know.
It was enough to like I said, it was enough to win a book award. It was, I mean, it's surprising because Lash was not so, like, which is actually really funny to me. Like when you read the books, like, wow, how could this have been a bestseller? Because the stuff that has aged the most, like, as much as I love this book, parts of it have not aged well. And that's the Freud, and that is the Freudianism in it, especially because Freudianism has been so thoroughly discredited. That's the unfortunate tragedy of this book. And I think that's part of the reason why the book had a success that was also quickly forgotten, because it was at first taken as a critique of the me decade. And then when people actually started to read it, and it's like, what is this stuff he's talking about? What is this Freudian stuff he's talking about? I think that kind of damaged, and this is just me speculating, but I think that might have damaged the book's credibility in some sense, because people were already starting to move past Freudianism by that point. Freudianism had like a weird kind of journey in the 20th century. I mean, like it was extremely potent in the early part of the 20th century, especially when Freud wrote Civilization and Its Discontents, which is what led to a lot of this managerial revolution type stuff of having these psychiatrists basically trying to manage society in order to temper the dangerous impulses that supposedly existed in the mass of people. And then you had when Freudianism kind of when Freud died and like a lot of Freudian stuff started to kind of lose favor, it did have a resurgence with philosophers like Jacques Lacan, a French philosopher. But once that fad also died, it's just Freudianism finally kind of died the death it should have died a long time ago. And unfortunately for Lash, he was too influenced by that it's, I think it's damaged some of the credibility of it. At the very least, it makes the book look extremely outdated at times, which is very unfortunate, because the parts where he doesn't engage in Freudianism remain very, very prescient and very urgent.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. He codifies a lot of his arguments and kicks off the book, and a lot of his diagnoses, for want of a better term, come from the language of psychoanalysis and the sort of Freudian lens. So without an understanding of that or some background, yeah. But obviously, as you rightly point out, as Freud went down, so too did some of that terminology and those kind of critiques. I think, ironically, given the book's content title, I think that its success, at least as, you know, one of the best sellers at the time, might have been because people wanted to be seen reading it.
That's what I said. Like, my assumption is like people were like, because like the 70s like had exhausted itself. I mean, especially by the end of the decade, disco was basically like this fake and gay meme. It was for people who don't know, like, the history of disco, it only was around for a couple of years. It started based off of an article that occurred, like, that was written, I think, in some magazine about, like, a scene in the disco scene in New York, which was pretty much completely fabricated. Like, there was nothing, like, true about that. Like, what they were describing, they basically engineered this thing, and it became this thing that, like, was everywhere. Like, this is, and that's actually what caused, like, people to really hate disco, because it was so saturated. It got to the point where, I don't remember what year it was, and it might have been 1979, to be honest. I don't know what year it was, and I don't know remember the whole context for it, but there was, like, it got to the point where they had, like, a demolished disco night at a sports stadium, where the bunch of working class dudes basically burned a bunch of disco records or destroyed disco merchandise. I forget the exact context of all of that, but
the night of the burning lycra.
Yeah. it was a weird time period, and, like, that's why I think people were really, because, like, people were basically extremely burned out by the cultural decadence of the 1970s. That's why we had this supposed conservative backlash that brought us into the 80s. And you saw this across the world. You saw you had the election of Margaret Thatcher in the UK. You had the election of Ronald Reagan in the United States. It was supposed to be, mourning in America. This was, did the Australians also have, like, any kind of a conservative backlash that brought you guys into the 80s? Or did you have I don't know what, if you had a Labour prime minister at the time or what.
I'm sure DeMarc will check me on this, but we seemingly had at least our variant of a conservative government for a very long time, leading right up into the election of somebody. Was it Whitlam, DeMarc? That was kind of the turning point.
Yeah, I guess Whitlam would be the turning point. He was well and truly before the 80s, though, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I guess that's not too surprising. I mean, I think up until a certain point, Australia was generally one of the more conservative Anglosphere countries, if not the most conservative for a time. I could be wrong about that. It's just my speculation.
Yeah, no, I mean, it would be interesting to look back. I think societally, Australian culture shared a lot of the same beats as American culture through this. I've talked to some people who were alive at the time, and they said that they had a feeling that disco was just never going to end. And there was an era of sort of, liberalism and materialism and stuff that went through that, sort of this hyper vanity. And they felt like it was never going to let up.
Which is funny, because disco only lasted like 2 or 3 years, I believe, at the most. It was not like that's what's always annoys me about any kind of, like, TV series or movie that tries to depict the 1960s or 1970s. You think, like, looking at the 1960s, like, 1960 hit, and then you had the Beatles and JFK, and then it was hippies all the way out until the 1970s, when it was disco all the way out. It's like, no, like, these were very specific cultural snapshots, and, like, a lot of the stuff was a very brief amount of time, comparatively speaking. It seemed like a long time for a lot of people who were living through it, especially because, like, they were, like, everything was so bewildering. Like, it was so out of step with the culture, and so bizarre, and it overtook the culture that normal people just couldn't deal with it. There was a clip from Dragnet that actually went viral a couple of years ago, where basically it was, I don't remember what year it was. It was 1960s though, where Joe Friday is chewing out these youngsters, In following the timeline, they would have become hippies at some point, or pretended to be hippies later on in life. That pretended that they had been hippies, but basically, the youth, the discontent of the youth was already being felt in the 1960s, and he's basically chewing them out for, like, you're being young and stupid and you don't know what you're doing kind of stuff. This these currents were occurring, like, you had these deep undercurrents that were occurring, and people just didn't understand what was going on or what they were living through. And then when people try to look back on it, then it seems like everything just kind of gets mashed together in some way.
Yeah, I think some people say that hindsight's always 20/20, but I think it's always subject to the quality of your analysis and what kind of information.
No, not I mean, fact
check myself.
Not only do I not think that hindsight is 20/20, but it's also like that's the thing, because that's the problem. Like, people tend to like, it's everything becomes a blur basically. Like, it all just kind of like starts to blend together, especially like the amount of drugs everybody was on. It's I sometimes distrust people's memories of that time period. So you, like, the best kind of I think the best way to get a sense of what was going on at the time is actually to check out media from that time period.
Disco never actually happened. It was just a mass hallucination completely.
God, if only.
Yeah, Saturday Night Fever is a super fiction. It's a historical, you know, hyper reality piece. I'd fact check myself too. It was Malcolm Fraser was elected in 75, so. Boys, I think you were right. Yeah, we had a bit of a conservative kick. He was in for 3 terms. He was a leader in our sort of conservative party.
Yeah, and you got what was his name? Fraser?
Malcolm Fraser, yeah.
Yeah. So you have Fraser, you have Reagan, you have Thatcher. And Canada had what was his name? I think it was Brian Mulroney who kind of like also had that. I mean, like that. I mean, like Canadian conservatism. Like I believe it. And if I'm getting the right one, Mulroney was. I mean, like, he was a progressive Canadian. It's like, okay. basically just like Reaganism.
He was a Canadian,
but very light. Yeah, Canadian Reaganism basically. But like, you have all the that, and that's, I guess that's the point I was getting to off all of this. I kind of went off a tangent there, but like, you have all across like the Anglosphere countries this kind of backlash that's occurring, and it's because of what was going on in the 1970s, and people just had enough of it. It was especially like in the United States with the presidency of Jimmy Carter, that paved the way more than anything. It just didn't seem like anybody was in control of the country anymore, not just on the presidential level, but on the cultural level. People want, I mean, like, this is where you get the rise of the moral majority, the religious right, basically. They had their backlash because, like, basically Protestantism in the United States had been dying a very slow death. People wonder, where did this evangelicalism come from? It's because, like, the low church Protestant experience had basically died ignoble, sad, slow death where there was no vibrancy to it anymore. I mean, people, like, you know, what happened to the Puritans that became the Congregationalists? What happened to the Congregationalists? Well, their churches just started getting shuttered. Nobody, like, when after World War II, like, it was, there was this quiet crisis of faith that came across the Anglo. I don't know. Actually, I shouldn't say like all the Anglo sphere countries. Like, it came across the United States though, and you saw. Yeah. I mean, like, even in particular, like, you do see in other places. Like, there was the Quiet Revolution in Quebec, which because that actually used to be the really religious province of. Much more religious compared to France, and the Quiet Revolution and like brought secularism into the country, into the, oh my God, Canadians are gonna kill me, into the province. it's my latent Quebecois blood coming through right there. But no, you basically had like these Protestant churches dying their slow death as basically this materialism began to take over, and this liberalism as religion began to really take over. And so since these people weren't going to convert to Catholicism, or maybe they had been lapsed Catholics themselves, people were looking for a religious kind of experience, something that like a true spiritual truth. And that's like evangelicalism filled that vacuum basically. That's where that all came from. And then they began to coalesce and seek power, and that's where their run in the 80s started, really.
Yeah, it's I suppose I'll circle back by way of introducing the kind of deep dive through the book. So Lash puts forward, yeah, I think his points around and that evolving out of, you know, religion and people not having those affiliations, and the 60s being an era of liberation and a kind of individualism and free love movement, etc. But his contention is that it really backfired hard because people found themselves without anything to ground them, or and still with the you know, some of the same drives. So what traditionally would have been the domain of religion or the family became the domain of the media and the corporation, and, you know, all of those drives capitalized upon by, I think you rightly identify, you know, maybe evangelicals or people who went into the business movements of the 80s and then really ran with it from there. His analysis, as we talked about, you know, sort of psychoanalysis, that's his framework and kind of Freudian. And there are two categories of narcissism that he identifies or puts forward, which is primary and secondary narcissism. So there's a little bit of background to understand the book, and I encourage everyone obviously to go and read it for yourself. But primary narcissism comes from early relationships in the family and realizing that you and your desires have to coexist in the world with other people and other individuals. And then there are prevailing norms, which he refers to as ego ideals, which are things like maybe selflessness and, you know, fealty to institutions, that kind of stuff, that, you know, without those, a society can be quite dysfunctional. Well, as we've seen, and Lash asserts that the kind of ego ideals are the things that organize or frame societies broadly. You can maybe understand the superego as a conscience, perhaps. I mean, did you get that same thing, DeMarc or Boers?
I'm sorry, so you can understand the superego as what exactly?
Like a conscience, like a personal values heuristic.
That was a Freudian term. So that was already defined by Sigmund Freud earlier.
Yeah.
Basically, on the scale of how subconscious to how conscious or super conscious, is that a term? But that's basically the more outward and the more, like, the more of an idea of self you operate with, I guess.
Yeah, I just kind of doing some really. I can. It's been a long time since I had to like understand and learn Freudianism, but just quickly, the superego has to be understood as part of the three part aspect. Basically, you have the id, the ego, and the superego. And the ego is as you are. The id is basically it's the animalistic, infantile passions and desires and pursuits that you seek. Like, if you want to get like a good example of like an id, just go look at my Twitter feed, where it's basically just a verbal diarrhea of all my like various like just like I often joke that you can actually get a good idea of what Freud calls like the sexual death drive on my Twitter feed sometimes when I tweet about being murdered by tall beautiful women, which these are jokes I do, but like you can get like a good idea of like Freudian psychology if I just look at my Twitter feed. But like that, the id represents all that kind of stuff. Ego is you as you are, basically, you know, making these decisions. You're being informed by the id, but you're also being informed by the superego, which is the higher function of it. Like, this is like you trying to apply like principles, moralities, all this, because like that stuff's basically bolted on. When the ego without the superego is going to be led around by the id no matter what, just because the id is so much more powerful. And the superego is what basically applies the pressure on keeping you from completely indulging into your id.
Well, that's one of Lash's arguments there. He says that without the demands or the regulation and restraints of the superego, ultimately we're led around exactly by sort of the ego is slave to the id and led by guilt, which transforms into narcissism. Is that fair? Sorry, DeMarc, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, to put it simply, your superego is the long poster within you that wants to write threads on Lash like Borzoi does. Your ego is just you tweeting about your day, and it is you when you suddenly tweeting just the word come without any context.
Yes, that is a perfect summation of it right
that's
there.
That's it. All right, that's the show. Thanks, everybody. Oh, that's great. Yeah, I think I can't follow that. That's amazing. That's pretty well it. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're going to characterize Freudianism, that's as good as characterization as anything. So that kind of frames a lot of his critiques and arguments that follow forward. So this culture of narcissism that he puts forward is a result of the collapse of the superego and the id always being prevalent and always kind of being there, however you want to term it, and now being led by different motivations. And those motivations have come up in the wake of the collapse, more traditional structures, family yeah. institutions, that kind of stuff. And people who can literally capitalize upon that shortfall did so, well, and led people by their ego.
The weirdest thing about all that stuff is, like, I just, like, you get, like, if you try to, like, if you try to follow Lash's analysis from the Freudian thing, from the Freudian stuff, it's like, it gets bogged down in that, and I don't find it to actually be that persuasive. But the funny thing is, all of his, like, what he analyzes from that is almost always spot on. It's like he somehow had, like, the wrong process for analyzing all this, but still came to all the correct conclusions. It's one of the, like, that's what made this book one of the weirdest books I've ever read, where it's like, what are you talking about, Lash? And it's like, I don't know how you got to this point, but this is the correct point you made. Like, my math teachers always had a similar experience with me. It's like, how, like, and they looked at my work, it's like, how did you get to, like, the answer is correct, but none of the work makes sense. Like, how did you derive the correct answer from the work you did to get to that point? I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. Like, I almost think that Glash, like, intuitively understood what was going on and was trying to find something that made sense to it, especially because, like, if you watch Adam Curtis's documentary, The Century of the Self, it puts everything into context. I think that's actually what it is, kind of, in a way. It's like Lash thinks that's these Freudian psychological things that are going on that's creating. It's like, no, it was Freudians who were basically trying to engineer society that got to that point. It's like he's trying to apply Freudian analysis, like, as though, like, this was something that naturally occurred, when it's like, no, it was basically a bunch of Central European refugee psychoanalysts that did this to the culture.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. I think that's the elephant in the room. And he does address it directly in some points, but for sure, I think if you were a teacher marking, you know, this from that perspective, you would be very surprised at the path that he takes to the conclusions. He sort of retrofits this Freudian psychoanalysis take onto most things. But when he deviates from it, or even when he doesn't, quite rightly, yeah, the conclusions that he reached and the arguments that he makes are sound. And they've also borne out, considering this work was published in 79, we're still talking about it, obviously, right now, and in popular culture today, it still holds a lot of weight. Did you have any other insights, Damon?
Yeah, I do get the sense he might have started with the conclusions and worked backwards. So he might have gone, okay, we've got this culture of narcissism, but there must be some way they're, like, you know, some sort of sense that they are their own father's penis that leads to this.
Yeah, and it all goes back to a deep longing. You know, the other ignored them, so they're now seeking recognition from everyone else. Yeah, half a chapter in there at some point about relationships between the father and the family and the father and children. Yeah, it gets very Freudian at points.
Yeah.
So, you know, reader beware.
And I can understand, like, that's the weird thing about all this, because, like, and he says this in the afterword, like, when he was trying to basically help people understand, like, years later, help people understand what the point of the book was, because, like I said, it was kind of a misunderstood book at its time, is that this was a book about the American family life. That's what he was trying to analyze. That was what he was trying to get at. And so in that sense, I can almost understand why he gravitated towards Freudian analysis, because Freudian analysis is, like, at its core about analyzing your relationship with your father and your mother, basically. Like, so he's seeing the destruction of the American, like, because that's, like, and that's why, like, it was cultural conservatives that kind of kept the torch of Lash alive for as briefly as it was lit, because like, they were the ones most concerned with the destruction of the family, and Lash was very concerned about that. And he's looking at, like, why is the family, the traditional family, absolutely imploding right now? And so he starts working backwards. He's like, okay, there's a lot of, basically these people don't want to be members of families. They're extremely alienated. And he was a neo-Marxist, so alienation was a big part of his analysis. He starts working backwards, and he gets to the point, it's like, okay, like, and that's where he kind of went wrong, really. It's like, okay, the family's imploding. Obviously, there's some, and he was correct to note, like, this is like a systemic thing. Like, he's pointing the finger basically at liberal capitalism and the late liberal capitalism. But he sees that they're exploiting basically these Freudian elements that are within the family, and he's kind of missing the forest for the trees, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what I'll... I found a quote, and I was going to use it to introduce the show, and I think we segued pretty nicely into it. After this, we'll suppose we'll dive into maybe a little bit of a chapter by chapter, or talk about the different themes that he goes through. So the quote is from chapter 7 of the book, which is the titled The Abdication of Authority and the Transformation of the Superego, which is a little bit of a mouthful. But for those of you playing at home, it's page 169. And he says, quote, "The psychological patterns associated with pathological narcissism, which in less exaggerated form manifest themselves in so many patterns of American culture, in the fascination with fame and celebrity, the fear of competition, the inability to suspend disbelief, the shallowness and transitory quality of personal relations, the horror of death, originate in the peculiar structure of the American family, which in turn originates in changing modes of production. Industrial production takes the father out of the home and diminishes the role he plays in the conscious life of the child. The mother attempts to make up to the child for the loss of its father, but she often lacks practical experience of child rearing, feels herself at a loss to understand what the child needs, and relies so heavily on outside experts that her attentions fail to provide the child with a sense of security. Both parents seek to make the family into a refuge from outside pressures, yet the very standards by which they measure their success and the techniques through which they attempt to bring it about derive in large part from industrial sociology, personnel management, child psychology, in short, from the organized apparatus of social control. The family struggle to conform to an externally imposed ideal of family solidarity and parenthood creates an appearance of solidarity at the expense of spontaneous feeling, a ritualized relatedness empty of real substance."
So I'll kind of summarize that for people, because that's the problem with Lash, is like he uses a lot of language and the concepts might not come readily to the average person. But what Lash is basically saying there is that you have this rise of single motherhood, or just generally like emotionally absent fathers, and it's creating this situation where these people are becoming dependent upon the professional helper class, because they're not able to navigate this managerial bureaucracy we live in late stage capitalism, basically. And it basically, they start to conform to these imposed ideals that are basically like impossible and also just not natural to what they are as human beings.
I think that's a really good summary.
Yeah, and that's like, I mean, that's like what then people might wonder, like, how does that like create narcissism? Well, when you're, this actually kind of gets into like a very Kaczynskian type critique, which is why I think there's something we can get to that in a moment. But like, I think being Lash and Kaczynski both being Silent Generation people, I think they saw something that was going on. Like, I think a lot of Silent Generation people saw this, but basically like it was creating the system where the need, because like they were the generation that needed to conform to begin with, and they were seeing like the way that this was evolving was it was creating these extremely entitled people who were extremely, the term that Kaczynski uses is over socialized, meaning that they're very sensitive to the conditioning of what the system asks you to believe in and to internalize, and also in having feelings of inferiority. And when you combine these two things together, you tend to become very indulgent in interpersonal narcissism, especially as you attach yourself to certain identities that the system tries to impose upon you, which just aren't if the system did not give you dozens of identities to try and associate with, you wouldn't think of them yourself or identify yourself with them. You'd just be a human being, basically.
And you'd be relying more on, I suppose, the traditional structures and interdependence, or systems of interdependence that characterize those, and your own instinct or competence, as opposed to class of bureaucrats or experts, which Lash refers to again and again. And I think that Kaczynski might talk about as the technological society or the industrial society and its products.
And the technological society is a term he borrowed from Jacques Ellul, who was a French philosopher, from whom basically Kaczynski got his education on what society is becoming. For people who aren't familiar with the work of Jacques Ellul, he wrote two very important works. He wrote more works than that, but his two most important works were The Technological Society and Propaganda. Mm-hmm. And both of them are works that should go pretty much hand in hand with each other, where basically Ellul explains how the way technology evolves in an industrial system, basically society has to be restructured and reordered around technology. A good example of this, because the people tend to have a very myopic view of technology, because they see the gadget that they that they buy that seems to make their life easier, and so they think of technology as making their lives better. What they don't see is how the technological system works. Like, take roads for instance, and it's man doesn't shape technology, but technology shapes man, basically, because when you have roads, in order to have automobiles, you have to have roads, and in order to have automobiles on roads, you have to have a system that provides order on the roads in order to avoid the chaos. Like, you can't have cars driving wherever they want, especially as you add more cars to the roads. And then when that happens, cities begin to have to be planned. And everything begins to shape around the technology itself. And that's the key thing that people tend to not see when they first encounter ideas about technology. They don't see how that it's you're not doing whatever you want with technology. Like, your form, there's the old Frank Lloyd Wright kind of saying about when it comes to architecture, form follows function. In this case, societal function. Would work the same way here. Like, I was getting mixed up, but yeah, form follows function, basically, in terms of how society is structured around technology.
Mm. Taking a form to follow the functions of the technology rather than the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because what people think is that we already have a set form, and then we have a technology that functions for us. It's like, no. I mean, in order for that technology to work, in order to have in order to have cell phones, you have to have cell phone towers. In order to have, in order to have data on your smartphone, you have to have places where the data can come from. And so, in order to set that stuff up, you begin to restructure society and restructure land around that. And then people begin restructuring their lives around that. And that's when that begins to happen, it does weird things to families, it begins to do very weird things to the family structure, for one. I mean, you have the very basic take of everybody on their devices and the like.
Mm-hmm.
It fundamentally shapes everything. It changes everything. And this is Kaczynski and Lash are kind of keying into two separate different things, but they're what they're seeing is kind of at the same, this is also part of James Burnham was calling the managerial revolution. But you're seeing all these things converge all at once. Everything becomes an all-encompassing system. And human beings aren't really prepared for that whatsoever. Like, it's not natural to us to be that way. It's why you're seeing this skyrocketing levels of mental illness and social dysfunction, because this is not how we're meant to live, basically. And this is not to say that, if we all scale back, then things would be fine. Life would be hard. I mean, you ask somebody, it's a shame we don't have access to the elderly to hear about how things used to be. Like, life gets really hard. That's the good old days suck, but they didn't have this level of social dysfunction and problems, and narcissism derives from all of that as well.
Yeah, I think making the explicit links between the societal ills and their influences that Lash points out, and narcissism, is kind of what forms the substance of most of the book. Did you have anything else before we...
you cut out for me. What was that?
Oh, sorry. I was just saying to DeMarc, did he have anything else before we dive into the big review? But yeah, I was just saying that a lot of the book is about making those explicit links between those societal ills and narcissism itself from Lash.
I do have a thing I want to let DeMarc speak here, but like before we get dive into the book, I do want to read something from another book before we dive into the book.
Oh, great! Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but go ahead, DeMarc.
I was just going to say, he doesn't go off topic. This is 100% about narcissism. I think he ties essentially everything he covers to narcissism.
Yeah.
So this takeaway, I think we've already summarized the very foundational bit there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to give one final foundational thing, because like I did mention that both Lash and Kaczynski because Kaczynski's still alive, were our silent generation. Lash was born, I believe, about 8 years before Kaczynski. Kaczynski was a late silent generation guy, but it's got to get an idea of what they were seeing, you know, growing up. This is from Harvard and the Unabomber, The Education of an American Terrorist by Alston Chase, who's also a silent generation guy. He went to Harvard, actually. And that's actually why he got interested in Kaczynski, because both of them were Harvard alum who were kind of within the general time frame of each other. And he would always wonder, like, how could somebody like Kaczynski, a brilliant mind like his, do the things he did? So he wrote a whole book trying to piece this out. It's actually where a lot of the information about Kaczynski and the Henry Murray experiments comes from. It comes completely from Alston Chase. But indeed, the Kaczynski family, this is for anyone who's got a copy, but this is from page 167 in Harvard and the Unabomber. Indeed, the Kaczynski family could hardly not be affected by the growing tension and despair of the period, for it was part of the air one breathed back then, putting its stamp on an entire generation. Kaczynski, like myself, is a member of what William Manchester dubbed the Silent Generation, that cohort of Depression babies born between 1925 and 1942. Never, Manchester wrote, had American youth been so withdrawn, cautious, unimaginative, indifferent, unadventurous, and silent. The Silent Generation was a phenomenon of the 1950s, as characteristic of it as tail fins and white bucks. A vast hush had settled over the universities. There seemed to be no indignant young men on campuses, no burning causes, and no militancy. Actually, our generation was not so much silent as ignored, repressed, and fearful. Growing up in a world on the brink of thermonuclear war, calmness became our facade, obscuring mounting anxieties. Born during the Depression, we were fewer in number than either our predecessors, the GI generation, or our successors, the baby boomers. We weren't sufficiently numerous to have had a major impact on politics, the economy, or popular culture. No one from our generation would become president. Advertising, consumer products, movies, popular fashions focused on the more numerous baby boomers. Born during a time of economic collapse, we felt materially insecure. Born before the discovery of penicillin, we felt our own mortality. We saw our friends and siblings succumb to childhood diseases such as whooping cough, measles, mumps, scarlet fever, chickenpox, meningitis, pneumonia, and tuberculosis. We watched polio epidemics leapfrog the country, claiming thousands of victims, leaving countless children and adults paralyzed or confined to iron lungs for the rest of their lives. Growing up during World War II, the Cold War, and the Korean War, we had never known peace. In that pre-pill culture, dread of unwanted pregnancy poised like a sword over teenagers of both sexes. Indeed, fear formed the backdrop of our lives, fear of poverty and unemployment, fear of death from disease, fear that our fathers and brothers would come home from the war in caskets, fear of unwanted pregnancy, and perhaps most pervasive, fear of failing to measure up to our parents' expectations of us. Fearing that sickness might claim us too, our parents were overly protective and strict. Children were to be seen, but not heard. Pediatricians and parenting books stressed strict discipline and warned that sparing the rod would spoil the child. We were constantly reminded to conform, to be good. As William Strauss and Neil Howe explained in their book Generations, kids read stories about Tootle, a little train that always stayed on the track and paddled to the sea, a little boat that reached its destination by floating safely with the current. At the movies, they watched Sparky, Alfalfa, and the little rascals scrupulously mind their manners whenever they encountered elders. As threats against national community deepened, children were bluntly told that older generations were making enormous sacrifices so they could grow up enjoying peace and prosperity. any day could bring devastating news: a layoff, a foreclosed home, the combat death of a father, a social and cultural no man's land. Their worst school discipline problems range from gum chewing to cutting in line. The pressure to conform came more from adults than from peers. We tried so hard to behave. As Gail Sheehy put it, the silence were so good they didn't know about drug raids, only panty raids. In their day, grass was mowed, coke was a cold drink, and pot was something a girl asked for at her bridal shower. Alcohol, Sheehy implies, was virtually their only vice. As adolescents, they drank too much and drag raced cars as big as tanks with tail fins. This repressive atmosphere and strict parenting made us turn inward. Silence became teenagers when to be a teenager was nothing. The lowest of the low, the novelist Pat Conroy remembered. Most of us kept quiet, attempting not to call attention to ourselves. We had no leaders, no program, no sense of our own power, and no culture exclusively our own, Conroy explained. Many were, like Kaczynski, straight arrows who neither drank nor did drugs and remained celibate into their 20s. But even those apparently dedicated to a frenzied pursuit of pleasure seethed beneath with anxieties and unexpressed emotions. And he gives a little bit more like of the political context at that point, but I think that paints a pretty good picture of what people like Kaczynski and Lash grew up with. And then, like, they're seeing this explosion, like how different the baby boomers were, like how the culture was geared towards them, and how this expression came out, especially on the university campuses, which is something that Kaczynski and Lash would have both seen. Kaczynski went to Berkeley. Kaczynski went to, what was it? I believe he taught at Berkeley, and he went to University of Michigan after he did Harvard. Kaczynski was seeing this like as basically a young 30-year-old man, because he was a late silent. Like, he's seeing all this. Lash had, like, Lash would have been in his 30s when the hippie and counterculture was beginning to go on the university campuses. They were seeing all this stuff, and like, considering what they, like, that connection that the silence had to the way things used to be, like this connection to their families and to the past and the anxieties that came from that, and they're seeing this complete rubber band effect that was going on in the culture. It must have been bewildering. I can only imagine, like, why they were trying to find out, like, what happened here? Like, how did this happen? Like, what, like, you know, just 10 years ago, everything seemed fine, and then nobody's normal anymore.
Yeah, I think that puts a really fine point on it. There's obviously a huge amount that you kind of could respond to there, but that frames it really nicely about the thoughts and attitudes that they would have had and Lash would have had going into this. I think you're right that it would have been really bewildering. It would have been and put the lie to a lot of the stuff that they had been staying in line for, as it were, and believing that, you know, that there was an order to things, and that they would sort of inherit parts of that order, and then it was sort of being dismantled before their eyes.
Yeah, I mean, the Japanese have a saying that applies to their very conformist culture: the nail that sticks up must be hammered down. And that's very much a good description as well of the silence. And so, like, to have that mindset and then see this ridiculous, like, culture of self-expression that was evolving in the baby boomer generation was, like, it was so counter to everything that they were taught growing up.
I think that sets us up really well to dive into the book proper. So we'll take a short break and we'll see you on the other side. welcome back. And this is the Big Leagues. We're going to dive through the whole book, go a bit chapter by chapter and drop some more detailed elements that we focused on individually. So the first chapter is titled The Awareness Movement and the Social Invasion of the Self. So did anyone have key takeaway points from this, or what he was kind of getting at, do you think?
Well, this chapter is definitely about basically this is a, which is why it's good to watch The Century of the Self. I think people should watch Century of the Self before reading this book, to be honest, but it'll give you a better appreciation for this. But this is where you see the implosion of the new left. This is like, it's, you can trace the development of all, in a lot of our culture from like how this, like just how this stuff failed. And in this chapter, Lash talks quite a bit about the Weathermen and like people that are related to all that. Like, you get a good sense of just like how this culture of self-expression and narcissism developed, especially out of these political failures. And if, like, especially like if you ever need, like, if for whatever reason you still didn't have enough proof at how vile the Weathermen were, like, this is the chapter that will give you a deeper appreciation for it. And it's not for nothing that a lot of the names he names in this are Jewish. Like, I've talked before about like the narcissism of the post World War II American Jew in America, like that have a cultural influence. There's a deep seated narcissism in a lot of them. And when you see the names that Blash references in this chapter, and once you kind of know what the ethnic origin of those names, it's going to give you a chuckle. It's like, this is a lot of Jewish people.
And he gets a bit more into the sort of personality type of these people quite a lot. He describes them as what he calls the Maravaldian man. Someone who doesn't think of a past or future, but just sort of lives in a series of presents.
Yes.
There's sort of a sense of impending doom because, you know, you're going to die one day and you're going to stop experiencing presents because you don't consider a future. And it sort of led to replacing religion with therapy. He calls the whole left movement essentially therapeutic instead of religious or political.
Mm.
Those are all interesting takes.
Yeah, one of our regular co-hosts, Mick, he put forward a quote to share on the show. Hi, Mick. He said, there's a quote from page 50, a society that fears no future is likely to not give attention to the needs of the next generation. Interesting.
Yeah, it's, well, I mean, that's kind of where you have to kind of start with ground zero when it comes to narcissism, because when you are so entirely focused on the self, like, the past becomes irrelevant, because what does the past have to inform upon you when you are all that matters? And then there is no, like, I really try not to pick on the baby boomers too much, just because, like, I, you know, you have to maintain generational continuity even with like generations you might not get along with. Like, you do have to like kind of see things, you have to be able to step outside, especially your personal animosities, and see the bigger picture. But there's a reason why the baby boomers lived through the me decade, why they were called the me generation, why and why they're the generation that seems to be the most disconnected from the past and future, who tend to have this view of like, well, what, like, it's not going to matter because I'm going to be dead. It's like, you do have children and grandchildren. You realize, like, well, that's their problem, not mine. That's on a very basic level of what like narcissism creates. So that's what it generates. So it completely divorces you from the past and from the future.
Hmm.
This is actually a good quote as well that kind of explains kind of like that mindset as well. After the political turmoil of the 60s, Americans have retreated to purely personal preoccupations. Having no hope of improving their lives in any of the ways that matter, people have convinced themselves that what matters is psychic self-improvement, getting in touch with their feelings, eating health food, taking lessons in ballet or belly dancing, immersing themselves in the wisdom of the East, jogging, learning how to relate, overcoming the fear of pleasure. Harmless in themselves, these pursuits, elevated to a program and wrapped in the rhetoric of authenticity and awareness, signify a retreat from politics and a repudiation of the recent past. Indeed, Americans seem to wish to forget not only the 60s, the riots, the new left, the disruptions on college campuses, Vietnam, Watergate, and the Nixon presidency, but their entire collective past, even in the antiseptic form in which it was celebrated during the bicentennial. Woody Allen's movie Sleeper. Very funny movie, by the way. You know, whatever you might think of him, and you should think all the things you think about him. Issued in 1973, accurately caught the mood of the 70s, appropriately cast in the form of a parody of futuristic science fiction. The film finds a great many ways to convey the message that political solutions don't work, as Allen flatly announces at one point. When asked what he believes in, Allen, having ruled out politics, religion, and science, declares, "I believe in sex and death, two experiences that come once in a lifetime." Having displaced religion as the organizing framework of American culture, the therapeutic outlook threatens to displace politics as well, the last refuge of ideology. Bureaucracy transforms collective grievances into personal problems amenable to therapeutic intervention. In clarifying this process, this trivialization of political conflict, the new left of the 60s made one of its most important contributions to political understanding. In the 70s, however, many former radicals have themselves embraced the therapeutic sensibility. Rennie Davis leaves radical politics to follow the teenage guru Maharaji Ji. Abby Hoffman, former leader of the Yippies, decides that it is more important to get his own head together than to move multitudes. His one-time associate, Jerry Rubin, having reached the dreaded age of 30 and having found himself face-to-face with his private fears and anxieties, moves from New York to San Francisco, where he shops voraciously on an apparently inexhaustible income in the spiritual supermarkets of the West Coast. In 5 years, Rubin says, from 1971 to 1975, I directly experienced Est, Gestalt therapy, bioenergetics, rolfing, massage, jogging, health foods, Chai Chi, Esalen, hypnotism, modern dance, meditation, Silva mind control, Erica, acupuncture, sex therapy, Reikian therapy, and Morehouse, a smorgasbord course in new consciousness.
I remember reading through that part. I looked all those up, or the ones that I didn't know already, just to get a feeling for the atmosphere of the time.
The most insidious one is the Reikian therapy. It's like, that's Wilhelm Reich.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't help but think of parallels today with the amount of people that are diving into the next, work sort of food or fitness craze, whatever the celebrities are sort of. It's the self same thing. It doesn't even bear listing them off because people will know for themselves, and probably more than I do. But yeah, just think of the goop mentality writ large, and that was pretty much the late 70s. Did you have anything more than that, DeMott?
I think that summarizes what I've for the chapter pretty much.
So the second one, a little bit more detail there. Chapter two is the narcissistic personality of our time. I had a quote from the beginning of that. So sorry to do so many block quotes. It's a good book. He says, quote, "Theoretical precision about narcissism is important not only because the idea is so readily susceptible to moralistic inflation, but because the practice of equating narcissism with everything selfish and disagreeable militates against historical specificity. Men have always been selfish. Groups have always been ethnocentric. Nothing is gained by giving these qualities a psychiatric label. The emergence of character disorders as the most prominent form of psychiatric pathology, however, together with the change in personality structure this development reflects, derives from quite specific changes in our society and culture. From bureaucracy, the proliferation of images, therapeutic ideologies, the rationalization of the inner life, the cult of consumption, and in the last analysis, from changes in family life and from changing patterns of socialization. All this disappears from sight if narcissism becomes simply the metaphor of the human condition, as in another existential humanistic interpretation, Shirley Sugarman's Sin and Madness, Studies in Narcissism," end quote. And I think that Lash was, sorry, go on.
I was going to say, the first chapter is basically identifying the social movements that were basically becoming narcissistic. The second chapter is basically about analyzing the narcissistic personality. And this can be a very deeply uncomfortable chapter, I think, for some people, because you begin to see how narcissism touches us at every step. You'll start to see aspects of yourself in some of the things he's describing.
Yeah, that's one of the things that really stuck out for me. And I suppose, again, reader beware with this book. You're going to identify with parts of it in yourself. I mean, you can't grow out of an aquarium and not get wet. We've grown up in an environment where we're surrounded constantly by narcissism and its products, literally in many cases. And, you know, expecting not to be touched by that or not to identify things that you do or behaviors you might have. But arguably, that's one of the benefits of reading the book, so you can understand those better and maybe mitigate against the worst of them.
Yeah, you will read this chapter and go, wow, I'm basically that guy from American Psycho, no meme. You will do that no matter who you are because you live in this age. So,
yeah,
I had a tweet on my thread about this where I later followed up with saying I was starting to sweat about what Lash was describing until I got to the last part. But I had tweeted, I am deeply uncomfortable at some of the character traits Lash is describing here. Because I was seeing myself in a lot of this. The refusal of recent critics of narcissism to discuss the etiology of narcissism or to pay much attention to the growing body of clinical writing on the subject probably represents a deliberate decision stemming from the fear that emphasis on the clinical aspects of the narcissistic syndrome would detract from the concept's usefulness in social analysis. This decision, however, has proved to be a mistake. In ignoring the psychological dimension, these authors, so there's my speech impediment, these authors also miss the social. They failed to explore any of the character traits associated with pathological narcissism, which in less extreme form appear in such profusion in the everyday life of our age. Dependence on the vicarious warmth provided by others combined with a fear of dependence, a sense of inner emptiness, boundless repressed rage, and unsatisfied oral cravings. Nor do they discuss what might be called the secondary characteristics of narcissism, pseudo-self-insight, calculating seductiveness, nervous self-deprecatory humor. Thus, shit.
It's like the laundry list of things that lead you onto doing a podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Thus, they deprive themselves of any basis to which to on which to make connections between the narcissistic personality type and certain characteristic patterns of contemporary culture, such as the intense fear of old age and death, altered sense of time, fascination with celebrity, fear of competition, decline of the play spirit, deteriorating relations between men and women. For these critics, narcissism remains at its loosest a synonym for selfishness and at most, and its most precise, a metaphor and nothing more that describes the state of mind in which the world appears as a mirror of the self.
Amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, there was one part later on in this chapter where he says that, quote, chronically bored, restlessly in search of instantaneous intimacy, of emotional titillation without involvement and dependence, the narcissist is promiscuous and often pansexual as well. So Lash called it, since the fusion of pregenital and Oedipal influences in the service, in the service of aggression encourages polymorphous perversity. The bad images he has internalized also make him chronically uneasy about his health, and hypochondria in turn gives him a special affinity for therapy and for therapeutic groups and movements. Jesus. I mean, that could be a masthead today, and I'd be like, that works.
He destroyed me in this part right here. Often these patients suffer from hypochondria and complain of a sense of inner emptiness. At the same time, they entertain fantasies of omnipotence and a strong belief in their right to exploit others and be gratified. The hypochondria part is where he destroyed me, basically. Archaic, punitive, and sadistic elements predominate in the superegos of these patients, and they conform to social rules more out of fear of punishment than from a sense of guilt. They experience their own needs and appetites suffused with rage as deeply dangerous, and they throw up defenses that are as primitive as the desires they seek to stifle.
It's amazing some of the prescient stuff in this chapter. I mean, not only did I find out that I'm like a massive narcissist, it's been really good doing this podcast. You know, I found from Evola that I'm like fake and rootless, and yeah, it's really smashing down the ego episode by episode.
Yeah, being on the right and doing any kind of book podcast, like when you read these guys that are smarter than you, it's basically just like every episode is basically discovering how much more worthless you basically are.
yeah, exactly. It's been a running joke for Democ too.
Yeah, up until now, every author's proven us to be gay and communist, except for Lash, who just proved that we're all narcissists. So cool.
So we gay and communist. One.
I think I found a apart from this chapter where he, I believe, fittingly predicted not only just the image conscious and obsessed culture, which is a dominant theme throughout the work, but I think this puts a really fine point on the new kind of grammable culture. I don't know if you're familiar with that term.
No, disgusting actually
not. Neologism that describes either constructing or setting up experiences or physical attractions that make them quote unquote grammable. which means that people will take photos of themselves or selfies on Instagram. Oh, it's like a marketing.
Got it.
Yeah, it's like some marketing newspeak that's come out from behind the, you know, glass doors. Anyway, he said, quote, "We live in a swirl of images and echoes that arrest experience and play it back in slow motion. Cameras and recording machines not only transcribe experience, but alter its quality." He predicted the dog filter guys, "giving to much of modern life the character of an enormous echo chamber, a hall of mirrors. Life presents itself as a succession of images or electronic signals, of impressions recorded and reproduced by means of photography, motion pictures, television, and sophisticated recording devices. Modern life is so thoroughly mediated by electronic images that we cannot help responding to others as if their actions and our own were being recorded and simultaneously transmitted to an unseen audience or stored up for close scrutiny at some later time." So not getting too meta, because it's exactly what we're doing, but I think that he kind of triangulated social media, Instagram, Twitter, podcasting, all that sort of stuff in the modern age. That's carried right forward.
Yeah, and that's why it's, you can actually kind of read Lash and Kaczynski together, and they're often talking about the same stuff in their own way, but they're often also they're talking about different things that address the same all encompassing issues. It's just that Lash focuses much more on a cultural level, whereas Kaczynski focuses much more on a political level.
So jumping forward, chapter 3 talks about, I think we've briefly touched upon the Protestant work ethic stuff. Chapter 3 is changing modes of making it, from Horatio Alger to, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, to the happy hooker. So he here talks about the previous importance of and the decline of that Protestant work ethic and how those drives have been co-opted by a new purpose. You said in the start of the show, the setup, quite a lot about this was, the flow from Puritanism all the way through to neo-capitalists and Reaganism. Did you have more from this chapter?
Yeah, I guess the kind of, I have a whole thing about his thing about Desaad at the end, because basically the reason why he ends up talking about Desaad is because he ends up kind of like talking about the bourgeoisie quite a bit and everything kind of about them, and that's why like Desaad comes up, because of the way he kind of prefigured, like in Desaad's attack on the bourgeoisie prefigures kind of like the sexual morality of our days, like when you have like this when everything kind of becomes like basically he took their stuff to the logical conclusion. When you made like man into an economic unit, then turns everything about them into a commodity, including their sexuality. We should talk a little bit about the Protestant ethic of this first, is that that was the very striking thing when you post the Reformation, when you look at the countries that became the Protestant countries, the Scandinavian countries, the Northern Germanics, and of course the English, is that, or rather I should say the British, because the Scottish are included in that as well, but you have this deriving from the way that Protestantism interpreted the Bible, like you had what was called the Protestant work ethic that developed out of that, a very 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 strong work ethic that helped produce the industrial capitalism. It's really not for nothing that when you look at where industrialism really got its start and really took off was in the Protestant countries. You can get really deep into that stuff, and especially in the United States, when you compare the agrarian South to the industrious North. Now, there's a lot of reasons for why that was the case. It's not just because of the religious divide. It's not just because of that. Part of it's also just like the circumstances of the lands that they were on, because the South was much more suited to being an agrarian environment, basically. But it really is not for nothing that the South was settled by the much more of the people who had cavaliers. For people who aren't familiar with the English Civil Wars, like you had the Roundheads, who were the Commonwealthers, basically, and the Cavaliers, who were the Royalists. And the South was much more royalist sympathizing. They were much more cavalier. And you see that in the culture, where they were much more agrarian, and they were also much less religiously focused and much less, not religious, like much more, that was such a bad way of phrasing that. They were just like they had less of that that Protestant industrious spirit, basically. Whereas the North, which is where the factories in the United States were like really first started popping up, those were places, especially in New England, that were settled by Puritans and other Protestant sects. Especially the two most purity spiraling of the Protestant sects were the Quakers and the Puritans, basically. Mm. Like the North was the heart of the industry in the early Industrial Revolution. That's where like you start to see this rise of the bourgeoisie, the people who own the means of production, develop, and then like their particular particular attitudes and their culture begins to come up through that. And because Lash is a critic of is a critic of liberal capitalism because he's a neo-Marxist, he zeroes in on that and sees like it, but he has a very nuanced view on a lot of the stuff. Like it's actually that's what makes it a fascinating chapter, to be honest, one of the strongest chapters I think in the book, because he's got a very nuanced view on all of this and but like on how you can see the roots of what would later become the culture of narcissism being in that present work ethic, because it turns the self inward and focuses so much on the individual compared to somewhat of the more kind of communal experience. Like I actually saw a thread from somebody who came from a Quaker family, and he's talked about like how Quakers are like the idea of the personal interpretation to its logical conclusion. Like they get bogged down in committee style stuff constantly because like, you're supposed to have this sense of consciousness and like speaking whenever the like you know you feel the spirit within you to speak, and but it gets so absurd and so ridiculous. They spent an entire year basically debating on how to change out a slide on a playground, basically.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you were talking about the I agree with you that this is one of the strongest chapters in the book, and his critiques are really quite detailed and even handed. There's a quote from later, which I thought was really interesting. It says, "In some ways, middle-class society has become a pale copy of the black ghetto, as the appropriation of its language would lead us to believe. We do not need to minimize the poverty of the ghetto or the suffering inflicted by whites on blacks in order to see that the increasingly dangerous and unpredictable conditions of middle-class life have given rise to similar strategies for survival. Indeed, the attraction of black culture for disaffected whites suggests that black culture now speaks to a general condition, the most important feature of which is a widespread loss of confidence in the future. The poor have always had to live for the present, but now a desperate concern for personal survival, sometimes disguised as hedonism, engulfs the middle class as well."
It is sort of interesting how it's gone from being niche to even our guys, you know, just copying Ebonics for the laughs, but and dropping in the occasional black relatable meme.
Yeah,
yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in using that irony.
Yeah, and he says on page 67. Do I have the? Let me pull up the page itself because like my the tweet I have on that misses some of the context that I want to get, and therefore here we go. Yeah, right here. Let's see here. I think this is actually coming off of what you were kind of talking about, like the same passage. Verbs associated with sexual pleasure have acquired more than the usual overtones of violence and psychic exploitation. In the violent world of the ghetto, the language of which now pervades American society as a whole, the violence associated with sexual intercourse is directed with special intensity by men against women, specifically against their mothers. The language of, this is where some of the Freudianism comes out, but I think this point's still strong. The language of ritualized aggression and abuse reminds those who use it that exploitation is the general rule and some form of dependence the common fate, that the individual, in Lee Rainwater's words, is not strong enough or adult enough to achieve his goal in a legitimate way, but is rather like a child, dependent on others who tolerate his childish childish maneuvers. Accordingly, males, even adult males, often depend on women for support and nurture. Many of them have to pimp for a living, ingratiating themselves with a woman in order to pry money from her. Sexual relations thus become manipulative and predatory. Satisfaction depends on taking what you want instead of waiting for what is rightfully yours to receive. All this enters everyday speech in language that connects sex with aggression and sexual aggression with highly ambivalent feelings about mothers. That was right before the passage that you read as well. But like it really highlights that as things break down, like language takes on a very sexually violent tone, and because like it becomes that imitation of the ghetto.
Yeah, there's I'll jump ahead, but before I do you want to just go through your Desaad analysis?
Yes. Let me pull it up. Let's see here. There's so much good stuff here. So amazing paragraph here showing how the culture of narcissism unmoors us from the past and future and positions us constantly in the present. Everything then becomes more about pleasure and self-gratification. Revolutionary individualism is the ultimate tool for capitalism. So this is from Lash here now. Older conceptions of success presupposed a world in rapid motion, in which fortunes were rapidly won and lost and new opportunities unfolded every day. Yet they also presupposed a certain stability, a future that bore some recognizable resemblance to the present and the past. The growth of bureaucracy, the cult of consumption with its immediate gratifications, but above all, the severance of the sense of historical continuity, have transformed the Protestant ethic while carrying the underlying principles of capitalist society to their logical conclusion. The pursuit of self-interest, formerly identified with the rational pursuit of gain and the accumulation of wealth, has become a search for pleasure and psychic survival. Social conditions now approximate the vision of the Republican society conceived by the Marquis de Sade at the very outset of the Republican epoch. In many ways, the far-sighted and certainly the most disturbing of the prophets of revolutionary individualism, Sade defended unlimited self-indulgence at the logical culmination of the revolution in property relations, the only way to attain revolutionary brotherhood in its purest form. By regressing in his writings to the most primitive level of fantasy, Sade uncannily glimpsed the whole subsequent development of personal life under capitalism, ending not in revolutionary brotherhood, but in a society of siblings that has outlived and repudiated its revolutionary origins. This is now back to my take. I have a bit like to kind of cover this, so if you guys need to jump in at any point, please do. Yeah, so sexuality inevitably becomes commodified in the market and inherently supports a culture of expressive and non-judgmental sexuality because parts become interchangeable. It's not for nothing that the sexually transgressive are comorbid with narcissism and other conditions. So back to last year. Sade imagined a sexual utopia in which everyone has the right to everyone else, where human beings reduced to their sexual organs become absolutely anonymous and interchangeable. His ideal society thus reaffirmed the capitalist principle that human beings are ultimately reducible to interchangeable objects. It also incorporated and carried to a surprising new conclusion Hobbes's discovery, the destruction of paternalism and the subordination of all social relations to the market had stripped away the remaining restraints and the mitigating illusions from the war of all against all. In the resulting state of organized anarchy, as Sade was the first to realize, pleasure becomes life's only business. Pleasure, however, that is indistinguishable from rape, murder, unbridled aggression. In a society that has reduced reason to mere calculation, reason can impose no limits on the pursuit of pleasure, on the immediate gratification of every desire, no matter how perverse, insane, criminal, or merely immoral. For the standards that would condemn crime or cruelty derived from religion, compassion, or the kind of reason that rejects purely instrumental applications, and none of these outmoded forms of thought or feeling has any logical place in a society based on commodity production. In his misogyny, Sade perceived that bourgeois enlightenment carried to its logical conclusions condemned even the sentimental cult of womanhood and the family, which the bourgeoisie itself had carried to unprecedented extremes. And so this is where I started to kind of go off a little bit. So Lash is right to see the Marquis de Sade as the patron saint of our age and the man who most embodies our culture's deification of the individual within Republican values. Sade, who, for those unaware, helped incite the storming of the Bastille 10 days before it occurred. Sade was not in the Bastille when the July 14th storming occurred, however, but Sade's presence permeates in the French Revolution. He was freed by the revolution, advocated for direct democracy in the National Convention, did guard duty for the revolution, and eulogized Marat. Lacan, whom I referenced earlier, Jacques Lacan, saw him as the counterpart to Kant. Simone de Beauvoir and other existentialists saw him as the embodiment of the most radical doctrines in individual freedom. So when Lash views Sade, he sees Sade's reduction of sexuality, of everyone belonging to everyone, as the key. And you see this so clearly. You see this so clearly in our culture, which puts zero value on chastity and sexual restraint. Lash already noted earlier that everything is reduced to the ghetto language of violent sexuality, and that goes hand in hand with this. The dirtiest word in our culture is incel. One of my most common talking points is that the end point of liberalism is inversion. The values radical liberals most cherish are almost always an inversion of something that is valued by a normal person. There's a deep-seated misanthropy in this, and so they hate democracy. And so is this where I think this might be? This goes on a bit more. I don't know if you guys want, like, if you guys get the gist there, if you want me to kind of finish this off. I do have about probably like 5 more minutes of this.
No, finish it off. It's a good point.
Okay. So back to Lash. At the same time, he saw that condemnation of woman worship had to go hand in hand with a defense of women's sexual rights, their right to dispose of their own bodies, as feminists would put it today. If the exercise of that right in Sade's utopia boils down to the duty to become an instrument of someone else's pleasure, it was not so much because Sade hated women as because he hated humanity. He perceived more clearly than the feminists that all freedoms under capitalism come in the end to the same thing, the same universal obligation to enjoy and be enjoyed. In the same breath and without violating his own logic, Sade demanded for women the right fully to satisfy all their desires in all parts of their bodies, and categorically stated that all women must submit to our pleasure. Pure individualism thus issued the most radical repudiation of individuality. All men, all women resemble each other, according to Sade. And to those of his countrymen who would become Republicans, he adds the ominous warning. Do not think you can make good Republicans so long as you isolate in their families the children who should belong to the Republic alone. The bourgeois defense of privacy culminates not just in Sade's thought, but in the history to come, so accurately foreshadowed in the very excess, madness, infantilism of his ideas, in the most thoroughgoing attack on privacy, the glorification of the individual in his annihilation. And so I believe I finished out, yes, I finished out the my take on this here, because I believe that's the end of the chapter right there. The liberal is a Democrat until he actually encounters how the normal person thinks and votes accordingly. Then their view of democracy changes. Democracy is always in danger. Democracy must always be prepped. Democracy has to be preserved for people voting anti-democratically. This is in the inversion and the misanthropy that goes to the heart of it all. If Sade had seen what the real results of direct democracy would have created, he would have desperately clamored to have his aristocratic status restored so that he could prep the people for democracy. The last few paragraphs from Lash are worth reading a couple of times, as there's a lot to chew on. In the end, radical liberalism does not result in liberation, but in men and women resembling each other as they submit to and for the pleasures of others to a perverted aristocracy.
Yeah, that's... if you take nothing else away from the show, that point about the end point of liberalism being an inversion of what may work or conform to a natural order... that's the takeaway. And Sade, even if it was a stop clock that was right twice a day, I think he aimed right at it and pointed out exactly that. In the afterword, which was written in this publication, or at least the one that I've got, Lash goes back to that, or he echoes your sentiments there. He talks about this concept of the, you know, economic crushing men and women into a sort of androgynous and amorphous mass. Yeah, for their own profit and sport.
Yeah, one of the last things, like, because Lash died, I believe he died in the 90s. I think it was 1996.
It was 94.
Yeah. 94. Okay, so yeah, so it's always important to remember, like, the context that people are living through and writing through. So one of the last things that Lash would have seen, the last full decade he lived through, the 1980s, was when androgyny became a fad and an in thing on the popular culture level. You saw this constantly in music, and you saw sexual and gender androgyny really becoming a thing on a much more mainstream level. Now that kind of was before now, that kind of took a dip for a while in the 90s and the aughts, and it's now come back in full swing. But back in the that's when that stuff like was in vogue. That's one of the last things that Lash is seeing before, you know, before he passes, is what was going on in the 1980s.
Yeah, well, he wrote the afterword that I just cited in 91, so I think you're right. Yeah, he would have seen that and diagnosed it. You were going to say, Demok?
I think that was...
It's hard to follow.
No, I don't actually remember interjecting, so I...
Oh, okay, sorry. Well, yeah, we can. I think you've, Borzo, set up really nicely there a point to jump forward. Chapter 4 is the banality of pseudo self-awareness, theatrics of politics and everyday existence. One pull-out quote that I have from this was the note that I detached to it is he calls out the consumer kuma.
This is the board. This is actually the Borzoi chapter right here, because like he references Debord and Jacques Ellul in this chapter. Yeah. Like, I was over the moon in this chapter. But go ahead.
Yeah, well, he said, the quote that I got it from was, "Quote: In a simpler time, advertising merely called attention to the product and extolled its advantages. Now it manufactures a product of its own, the consumer or consumer." Perpetually unsatisfied, restless, anxious, and bored. Advertising serves not so much to advertise products as to promote consumption as a way of life. It educates the masses into an unappeasable appetite, not only for goods, but for new experiences and personal fulfillment. It upholds consumption as the answer to the age-old discontents of loneliness, sickness, weariness, lack of sexual satisfaction. At the same time, it creates new forms of discontent peculiar to the modern age. This is a really good bit. It plays seductively on the malaise of industrial civilization. Is your job boring and meaningless? Does it leave you with feelings of futility and fatigue? Is your life empty? Consumption promises to fill the aching void, hence the attempt to surround commodities with an aura of romance, with allusions to exotic places and vivid experiences, and with images of female breasts from which all blessings flow. Jesus, like you really, end quote. He just nailed it to the floor. That's the consumer kuma called out firmly.
And the funny thing is, like, that was the quote before you started reading. Like, that was the quote, like, the section I was going to pull up as well. My note on this is the Borzoi section of the book with a focus on the cult of consumption. Note how Lash is also clued into alienation as commodity. Like, when I criticized Joker, the film Joker, and the Burger King unhappy meals as such. Creating your own alienation and selling it back to you as product.
Yeah.
The next part's actually well worth reading as well, like the paragraph that follows. The propaganda of commodities serves which gets into kind of the alienation as product that I was referring to. The propaganda of commodities serves a double function. First, it upholds consumption as an alternative to protest or rebellion. Paul Nystrom, an early student of modern marketing, once noted that industrial civilization gives rise to a philosophy of futility, a pervasive fatigue, a disappointment with achievements that finds an outlet in changing the more superficial things in which fashion reigns. The tired worker, instead of attempting to change the conditions of his work, seeks renewal in brightening his immediate surroundings with new goods and services. In the second place, this is the most important paragraph right here. In the second place, the propaganda of consumption turns alienation itself into a commodity. It addresses itself to the spiritual desolation of modern life and proposes consumption as the cure. It not only promises to palliate all the old unhappiness to which flesh is heir, it creates or exacerbates new forms of unhappiness, personal insecurity, status anxiety, anxiety in parents about their ability to satisfy the needs of the young. Do you look dowdy next to your neighbors? Do you own a car inferior to theirs? Are your children as healthy, as popular, doing as well in school? Advertising institutionalizes envy and its attendant anxieties.
Yeah, a lot of that chapter, which 3 led into, was selling you the idea that essentially you're a protagonist in a film, which is your life. And ultimately, a lot of this comes off on the idea that, you know, right now you're feeling bad because it's a low act, because you don't have commodity. But if you just buy commodity, you'll suddenly hit the peak of your movie and you'll be just like James Bond. If you just...
I'm so glad you called him out.
He's
one of the most egregious examples of that, and an inversion of everything that that character probably should have represented or purports to represent is exactly what we're identifying and talking about here.
Well, and the grossest like evolution of this that we're now seeing, Lash probably is like, well, of course they would, but I almost like wonder if like maybe like even he's like, there's no way they would be like this like egregiously gross about this. But the unhappy meal is like, to me, like just like the pinnacle of all this was like, we are part of a system that has objectively ruined and destroyed your life, and you are an incredibly unhappy, depressed sack of shit. So why don't you ironically celebrate that with an unhappy meal? You get it? Because like, it's a joke on Happy Meal. You're alienated and miserable, and you want to kill yourself. So celebrate that with the product that's killing you. Like, and celebrate that. It's like, that's like, they have taken this to a level that is just like, is just so absurd and obscene. Like, it's almost like on an evil genius level, like you almost have to stand back. It's like, wow, they really went there, huh?
It's like some evil executive was like, you know what, we're just gonna hire Banksy, he's gonna criticize us, but we're gonna fund him and it'll be funny.
Yeah, well, this is like this is okay. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna echo that. That's yeah, I think that's yeah. True, it's true. Well, they just have enough money, they don't need to give.
And this is something like Lash gets into, I believe, in the later chapters. I don't remember what chapter he really focuses on, but like basically a lot of like some of the one of the themes that derives from Lash's book, and this is going to be like something I'm going to harp on when we do like, you know, call to action, is like irony won't save you. And in fact, irony is used by the system basically to control you. It's like he constantly psychoanalyzes, in a good way in this case, like he constantly psychoanalyzes irony, and like, because like irony is basically a coping mechanism. David Foster Wallace like did a fantastic I wish I could remember what it was called, but like he did, like just look up his television essay, basically the David Foster Wallace television essay, because he analyzes irony in television, and he's analyzing it on a very Lashian level, basically minus the Freudianism for the most part. But there's a quote that he uses frequently that I've adopted that as well. It's like, irony is a bird that's come to love its cage. And that is what Lash is analyzing as well, for the way that people try to cope with how awful, like just like how awful this stuff is. And because it's awful in extremely subtle ways, like you sound like a crazy person or like a grognard or a grumbler or just like somebody who's looking for like, who like is trying to, who thinks their life sucks when it like they do have decent material conditions. It's like, the system designs it that way so you look like a lunatic when you're complaining about your life under its system.
And to expand on the irony thing here, his description, this might be a bit of a jump forward, but his description of Nixon, about how he was well aware what he was doing was cinema, he'd critique other politicians' performances and boasted of successfully lying years later. I think that's literally what would happen if you got a Twitter irony bro to be president. Like, yeah. He literally just went and did it for the bit.
Yeah. No, 100%.
So, yeah, Nixon invented the Twitter irony bro persona. Deserves credit for that.
Except Nixon at least Nixon, like, actually believed some things. So I'll give Nixon credit for that.
I mean, this chapter, if you read nothing else, this chapter really has just some fantastic insights into our current condition and state. There's one in particular, just to kind of, he not only called out the Twitter irony bro, also called out the groper wars. Now, hear me out. Later on, he talks about the kind of 1968 and New Left movement, Festival of Life, et cetera, pushes through to talking about briefly the Weathermen and other radical left organizations. But the quote that I had was, quote, yet these radicals had so few practical results to show for their sacrifices that we're driven to conclude that they embraced radical politics in the first place, not because it promised practical results, but because it served as a new mode of self-dramatization, end quote.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's a word that I probably overuse, but like, it's a good word, like performative. Like I always talk, like, cause like, online, like technology and online exacerbates this problem. Like, it accelerates this problem, really, of like people performing, like they're performing politics. And I actually, like, this was a tweet I said recently where I was like, I said, I'm gonna just have the kind of like paraphrase it basically, where most like people think they understand political power because basically they, you know, they participated in the meme wars, but like you never actually worked in like a political campaign, like you've never actually experienced anything that's political that has mattered. Like you participated in a cultural event, sure, but like that's not the same thing as political power. Like all you've done is you chose, like you were playing an MMORPG and you chose as your class political analyst, which for you might as well just be a wizard because it's just all magic to you. You don't understand how it works. You just know, like, you did a magic spell on the online world and something appeared to have happened and you think that was you that did that.
Because you're saying, you know, something you're looking for as a narcissist diagnosed by Lash. You're looking for reflections of yourself in the world outside. He points out a heuristic to judge this, where he says that, you know, narcissists, they seek to warm themselves in the reflected glow of these things. But do feelings control this strong admixture of envy? And his admiration often turns to hatred if the object of his attachment does something to remind him of his own insignificance.
Yeah.
I thought that's a really nice rule of thumb to have going forward, you know, as people involved in whatever this thing is. If you feel yourself that little twinge of envy or kind of, you know, being upset that you weren't part of the vanguard, yeah, maybe think about what your motivations were to begin with.
And the reflective, you know, trying to like warm yourself in the reflective glow, the only warmth you're feeling is from a blue light.
I think that's fair to say. Lash does touch upon that briefly as a section on advertising and propaganda. I'll just read from it. He says,
yeah, that's literally what I was going to do next.
All right, cool. Yeah. He says, in propaganda, as in advertising, the important consideration is not whether information accurately describes an objective situation, but whether it sounds true. It sometimes becomes necessary to suppress information even when it reflects credit on the government for no other reason than that the facts sound implausible. Hey, you want to take the rest of this one, boys? Do it.
I remember my tweet.
Go off, King.
Jacques Ellul explains in his study of propaganda why in 1942 the Germans did not reveal that the invincible General Rommel had been absent from North Africa at the moment of Montgomery's victory. Everybody would have considered it a lie to explain the defeat and prove that Rommel had not really been beaten. The Office of War Information in the United States, eager to use atrocities to inflame public opinion against Germany, deliberately avoided the most horrifying atrocity of all, the extermination of the Jews, on the ground that the story would be confusing and misleading if it appears to be simply affecting the Jewish people. Truth has to be suppressed if it sounds like propaganda. The only reason to suppress a piece of news, says an Allied handbook used in World War II, is if it is unbelievable. Maybe not the example I would have used, Lash. Maybe not the example I would have used, but I understand what you're trying to say here.
You get the point. You get where it was shooting.
Well, he goes further with advertising, and when he's talking about, because he's talking about a lull in this part, and so there isn't, like, this is me, there is no effective difference between advertising and propaganda. Advertising is propaganda, and advertising is pathos. The way advertising and propaganda functions, especially for smarter people, is to flatter their midwit narcissism and avoid appealing to anything higher. So this is from page 77 on the book. Ellul notes that propaganda uses facts not to support an argument, but to exert emotional pressure. The same thing is true of advertising, however. In both cases, the emotional appeal remains muted and indirect. It inheres in the facts themselves, nor is it inconsistent with the honest desire to be informed. Knowing that an educated public craves facts and cherishes nothing so much as the illusion of being well-informed, the modern propagandist avoids using high-sounding slogans. He rarely appeals to a higher destiny. He seldom calls for heroism and sacrifice or reminds his audience of the glorious past. He sticks to the facts. Propaganda thus merges with information.
Yeah, that's... I couldn't possibly follow that. That's really good. I mean, that's... Lash's takes and yours combined, but in this particular point, I figure it just really puts the lie to a lot of the advertising and the rest of it, the relationship that we think we might have, despite whether you're consuming things ironically or, you know, understanding propaganda and feeling like you're part of the in-group. you're probably not.
Yep. That's all I had on that.
I'm not sure if you got the same thing.
No, I 100%. But that's, like, I don't have anything else on chapter four. If you guys have any, if you guys have anything else on it, you know, go ahead and fill out whatever takes you guys need to get in, whatever notes you have, and I think we can get on to chapter five.
Yeah, no, definitely. I had a pretty obscure thing. He talks about theater of everyday life and narcissism as the theater of the absurd. Sort of diagnoses the contemporary playwright as just abandoning any efforts to portray truth or anything like that in the arts. And I was going to, you know, go on a bit of a tangent about, you know, that in popular culture. But I think we've probably spent enough time with this chapter. You should definitely look into it.
I also had a bit on the arts and all that. Especially his mention of Dionysius 1969. I think that actually ties into the Groip Wars because it sounds a lot like the TPUSA Q&A. But essentially, in Dionysius, the 1969 production of that play, they just invited the audience on stage to harass the actors or, you know, dry hump them, whatever. Apparently, they actually did that.
Yeah.
So they've just incorporated them into the cast, and that's really similar to the cinema that was the TPUSA Q&A.
Yeah.
Go on, Buzz.
It's just like that, like, that's basically, so go ahead. Like, I have a whole thing about theater, and I go ahead and get your take in while I collect my thoughts on this.
Sure. No worries. So just from the closing of the chapter, he really directly, I believe, calls out the NPC, obviously in different terms, but the quote was, "Imprisoned in his pseudo awareness of himself, the new Narcissus would gladly take refuge in an idea fix, a neurotic compulsion, a magnificent obsession, anything to get his mind off his own mind, even unreflecting acquiescence in the daily grind. As the possibility of achieving it recedes into the historical distance, comes to seem like an almost enviable state of mind. It is a tribute to the peculiar horror of contemporary life that it makes the worst features of earlier times, the stupefaction of the masses, the obsessed and driven lives of the bourgeoisie, seem attractive by comparison. The 19th century capitalist, compulsively industrialist in the attempt to deliver himself from temptation, suffered torments inflicted by inner demons. Contemporary man, tortured on the other hand by self-consciousness, turns to new cults and therapies, not to free himself from obsessions, but to find meaning and purpose in life, to find something to live for, precisely to embrace an obsession, if only the passion matrice of therapy itself." I feel like that, that's the end of the quote.
Yeah.
I feel like that read like a really fitting description of the NPC trope. So the lack of the internal monologue and being driven by this new cult of collective action to avoid any kind of introspection on that, and confronting the real horrors of contemporary life, as Lash puts it.
And what, like, and especially because just the average person is just not able to, like, I mean, like, we're not designed to be a mass of nothing but critical thinkers and the like, and even people who are intelligent people who are capable of critical thinking, like, will still have, like, you know, like, you're never going to be on all the time. And, like, we have human impulses, we have human, everything about us is still human. But theater is, like, an interesting thing to study. So, like, Dionysus 69 is tapping into some interesting currents in theater, but actually, like, it really shows, like, what happens when culture has to become, like, when culture itself becomes performative. So kind of like a little brief history of theater. So with, like, Greek theater, you have the concept of the chorus that's frequently in it. Now, in Greek theater, like, a lot of this was a way of purging emotions. If you read Aristotle, he talks about this. Like, this is where the term catharsis comes from. This is a way of purging emotions by basically seeing within the character, like, aspects of yourself, which allows you to kind of, like, get those emotions out into, like, it was just for the benefit of the collective unconscious, of, like, the kind of the collective spirit, in a way, to kind of, like, purge all of these, like, pent up emotions out. And that's why tragedy is always so focused on the, like, when you look at what a tragedy actually refers to, is a hero whose downfall is brought upon his by his own hand, basically, or by like violating the gods or like something within that milieu, basically. And so because of like we are like, you know, a pre-Christian man was the intelligent pre-Christian man was very cognizant of his, you know, of his flaws and was looking for a way of like kind of like not only just like understanding this through the gods, but also like a way of like dealing with this, like with what, like with the intense psychic toll of being a human, basically, of being a sapient being. This is a way of them expunging it. But like one thing that came out of this as well is you have the chorus, which like is often speaking, they're describing what's going on, but they're often like they're speaking directly to the audience. And this is a trend that has followed theater throughout most of its history, like with traveling troupes, like the actor, like the concept of the fourth wall often didn't exist or was very fungible, where the actors as characters would be speaking to the audience. There was no sense of like here's the walls and we are in the self-contained story that does not exist, like that, and the audience just does not exist within that actual world. And this continues on through comedian, like, and a lot of it was like very, like more, oftentimes it was very focused on in the comedy world, because like then you can play off the audience and whatnot. Commedia dell'arte was a big part of this. But this was also like current in tragedy itself. One thing, like for people who like Shakespeare, it's extremely well worth looking into the video about original pronunciation. So, and for people who aren't aware, like English, like it's not just that the language has changed in terms of like the words, the meaning of the words have changed. Like we've had our pronunciation of words shift constantly throughout the English languages period. It's not just like you have Old English, which is very Germanic sounding, and then you have Middle English, which is where you start to see some semblance of this. Like, and for people who don't know, like Shakespearean English is not Middle English or Old English or anything like that. That's modern English. They call it early modern English. That's why you can understand it. It's modern English. It's just like you're using words that aren't familiar to you anymore. But the pronunciation back then was also different. And when you, like, this video is very fascinating to watch, because when you actually hear it in original pronunciation, not only like do you feel like a deeper kind of like racial spiritual connection with the language, because like this is the language that your ancestors spoke, but the meaning of the text actually becomes a lot clearer, and you start to pick up on puns and everything that become much more clear. Like I forget which which play it's from, but there's a, when you look at the text, it looks like it says like from hour to hour we ripe and we ripe. Like, you know, kind of like indicating like, you know, we're growing old from hour to hour. But the way that it was spoken would have been like from or to or we rape and rape. And or was like how they pronounced whore, and rape is, you know, sexual relations. When a modern production, like you completely miss the pun in a modern production of that. That will not be clear unless you hear it in the original pronunciation. Even if you don't kind of realize like that or might mean whore, like I think like that part of your brain will pick up on that. But the point I'm making is part of that as well is like this is like the way that the play, the way that they did these plays was, again, it wasn't like on some raised stage where they're above the audience. And so like they're kind of, again, like they're like that, they're like this like entity outside of the audience that's self-contained and speaking amongst themselves. Like in Hamlet, when Hamlet is doing like his soliloquies, like, you know, to be or not to be, like, you know, should I kill myself or not, like, and a lot of these monologues and soliloquies, like these, they're not speaking just to themselves, they are actually speaking directly to the audience. And they'll be like, when they're basically like, you know, and like oftentimes like they're asking like the audience like what should I do, because like,
so it's rhetorical.
Yeah, well, it's not just rhetorical, like, but it's also like it's just like the fourth wall just didn't really exist in the way that we conceptualize it, because like these were rowdy audiences. Like the concept of like basically just sitting still and like, you know, watching a play and being very respectful and not saying anything would not have existed in this time period. Like these people, were hecklers. They like they shouted, they did stuff, and like the actors always played off that. So it was written towards that. Like there was audience interaction was baked into drama and performance. It's really when you start like the development of, like the way theater began to develop was where like it became a much, like, because you have to remember theater, or maybe people don't realize this, theater was a low art. It was like it was also very suspicious. Actors were frequently not given Christian burials because they were typically like very shitty people. Like they were considered very like you look at the history of traveling theater troops. Like they were often driven out of town and not allowed to do plays. Like, they were it was considered a very unchristian thing, like, especially like, in much more religiously minded times. In fact, when the Puritans took over in England, they actually shot like they banned plays. Like they were because like they were very serious about this stuff. Plays were banned, and that's why like when the restoration occurred of the monarchy, there was this revival, this renaissance. Like they call them, I believe they call them restoration plays, where they just like it all basically came back into style again. And that had its own particular culture. It was really like I'm not exactly sure when the turn came because my history of theater is not as strong as it should be. But I think it's about this time, like with the like going towards industrialization, but especially like the culture of the bourgeoisie, where you start to see they theater was a low art and they tried to raise it to a higher art. And that's where the fourth wall really starts to develop, where there's the separation now, and these become self-contained stories. But the idea of basically the actors interacting with the audience has always been a part of theater. And you started to see that come back with experimental plays in the 20th century. And so Dionysus 69 is not actually unusual in that regard. It was part of an undercurrent of a number of things. But what is the relevant point like that I've been building up to with all of this is that it's like it's bringing back performance to culture, and by encouraging the audience to become part of that, and they're also like in trying to infuse these cultural changes into all of that, like it kind of prefigured what was going to happen with the internet, where everything becomes performative, like especially when you're not supposed to have like a sincere and honest thought and feeling anymore, everything has to performance, and then everything has to become, and like you see this like you had this tension with the Groyper Wars, where like there were people who were trying to like ask very sincere, like very hard-hitting pointed questions, and then you also have people that were there like trying to create a meme moment. Basically they were trying to create like an own own on Charlie Kirk. That's performance. Like they're not like when you mix up like basically the dunk with the content, like you are engaging in performance. But unfortunately, a narcissistic culture demands performance more than anything else, especially with a technological one, because technology basically divorces you from any kind of sincere feeling and sense of sincerity. And because when you're an online persona, you're often performing just for the sake of like the humor, or like, I mean, like, you know, like that's why like it's preferable to be an irony bro on the internet, because like then you're not held account to like your sense of powerlessness, basically. You know, that's like I said, irony is a bird that's come to love its cage. Like that's where like that's like that I'm just like the whole point of this is like saying like the reason like it is Damoc was completely correct to note like the connection between the Grape Wars and Dionysus 69, but like there's a whole history as to how that would have developed to that point. Everything eventually became like the reason why this stuff is coming back is because our lives have become performance again. Instead of like now, though, the play being like this localized thing that you go and see, the play is our lives. Just like, you know, like ironically, when he was talking about he was really talking about the growth and death of a human being, Shakespeare was correct when he said all the world's a stage.
Yeah, I think all the world's a stage is a fair summary of this whole chapter. It's just going through the implications of that. Particularly especially in politics and art towards the end.
Yeah, also, I think that's... No, go on. Sorry.
Also fascinating, because Lash didn't quite cover that, and he sort of goes with the culture in assuming that the breaking down of the fourth wall and this self-awareness is new.
Yeah.
Of course, I think it's a little less healthy in our culture because it leads to works sort of being forced to have to be ultra self-aware to get critical credit.
Yeah.
And it makes art about making art, about making art, about making art.
The really esoteric thing that I was going to reference was the 2013 production of The Ring Cycle, but that's like so far out. But if you go and have a look into that, and the director behind it, it was the 200th anniversary of Wagner's birth. And they staged a production of The Ring Cycle, which is arguably one of, you know, it's one of opera's greatest achievements. It's sort of a 3-day thing, and it's one of these cultural masterworks that's been going for hundreds of years. But the person that staged the 2013 production, as you rightly point out, Demok, turned it into just art made about art made about art, and a performance about a performance. And it really sparked some pretty sharp cultural criticism and people, you know, hand rubbing and wondering what's going on with this, and why is this being put in front of us. It was just an interesting thing to dissect later on. Like I said, it's a bit esoteric. So the chapter overall, yeah, I think you said it right, talking about narcissism and propaganda as they manifest through art and advertising and politics. And it leads rather nicely into the next chapter, which is about the degradation of sport. But I think before we jump through to that one, now might be a good time to inject our musical interlude, as is tradition here at Roots of the Right. So what are we going to be listening to this time, Boz?
Oh, we will be listening to Surrender by Cheap Trick, which is a excellent song that's that basically, I think, encapsulates the baby boomers and the relationship with their parents.
Nice. All right, well, we'll drop that in for everyone to enjoy. We'll have a listen to, and we'll see you on the other side of the break.
Going right. G'day guys, Bronzo here. Just a quick public service announcement. The boys were kind of running out of time for this episode, so they decided to wrap it up at this point here. They're going to be recording a kind of episode 2 for this book, Culture of Narcissism, and that should be coming out sometime in the next week or so. So yeah, look forward to that, and thanks for tuning in.